Yeah, just start it right there.
Yeah. Excellent. Awesome. This is being taken away. Well, it has to stay. Okay. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Medical Ethics Society event on plastic and reconstructive surgery. Tonight, we are very lucky to have two speakers with us. The first is Dr. Gary Berger, who's a YU graduate. He went on to receive his medical degree at State University of New York Health Science Center in Brooklyn. He finished his internship in general surgery at Montefiore and a residency in general surgery at Beth Israel. And he then completed his fellowship in plastic and cosmetic surgery at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He is currently in private practice as well as a professor in Einstein. And he's going to present us with some of the medical issues about plastic and cosmetic surgery. And then we have Dr. Weiss, Rabbi Dr. Weiss, who is going to present us with some of the more halachic issues. He received his rabbinic ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of YU, and he earned his MD in Wayne State University. He's a licensed physician in the state of New York, and he completed his internship in internal medicine at Maimonides. He's currently the rabbi of the Young Israel of Hillcrest in Queens, and he's the adjunct assistant professor of biology at Stern College for Women. He has also served as staff physician for the Metropolitan Hospice of Greater New York. All right, so our first speaker is Dr. Gary Berger.
Good evening. I first want to thank Yona Bardos and Connie Schoenbrunn for asking me to join the program and for Rabbi Weiss to allowing me to join the program at the last minute. This is a bit of a milestone for me as a former YU guy. When I was in YU, Stern only had two buildings and I wasn't allowed in either one of them. So this is a first for me. The second thing I should tell you is that the last time I spoke at YU publicly, I was actually in Lamport Auditorium on the main campus, introducing for a YU Yom HaAtzmaut event. We had a relatively unknown comedian named Jerry Seinfeld performing, and I introduced him. And we kind of know what Jerry's been doing for the last 20 years, but I'm here to tell you more about what I've been doing for the last two decades. First, let me tell you a little bit about who I am. I come from a very YU family. My father from the Bronx went to MTA and then to Yeshiva College, married my mother from Brooklyn who went to Central and TI. They compromised and moved to Queens, where I grew up going to shul, one young Israel over from where Rabbi Weiss is now at the Mor Hadassara. In shul, I sat across the aisle from Kenny Brander, who is now a dean at YU and one of the faculty advisors of this medical society. And then I grew up and went to MTA, and I went to YU, and when I was in YU, one of my classmates in some of my pre-med courses was Eddie Reichman, who is another of your faculty advisors and is now not only an emergency room physician at Montefiore, but also a preeminent authority on medical ethics and halacha as well. As far as my YU background goes, I should probably also mention that I met my wife on a YU Stern ski trip when we were sophomores. She went on to Cardoza, of course, to keep YU in the family, and I don't know where my four kids are going at this point. After I finished medical school, I naturally trained at Montefiore and Beth Israel, which are part of Yeshiva University now. I did general surgery first as an internship and then a residency. General surgery, not plastic surgery, general surgery is the specialty of medicine where you take care of gallbladders and appendicitis and colon cancer, and you also take care of breast cancer patients. When I was a resident, the procedure we performed the most for breast cancer was called a modified radical mastectomy, which basically meant that the general surgeon removed all of the breast tissue and all of the skin from one side of a woman's body, if she only had it on one side, and then closed the wound. So the woman at the end of the operation was left rather deformed, where the front was as flat as her back, but with a very large disfiguring scar. And to be honest, we did this operation all the time. And it wasn't pleasant. And it wasn't pleasant dealing with the patients afterwards. It wasn't pleasant for them. It wasn't a pleasant thing, era to live through, really. But about 15 years ago, I was in the operating room with a general surgeon, which is what you do as a resident. You help whoever needs help. And I was with a general surgeon. We were doing a mastectomy, just like what I was talking about a minute ago. except this patient was going to have breast reconstruction by a plastic surgeon. And the reconstruction, the reconstructive plastic surgeon didn't have any help that day, and he asked if at the end of the mastectomy, when we were going to leave everything open for him to take care of, if I would stick around and help him. And I did, and it changed my life. What he did was he took an ellipse of skin from the woman's abdomen, took the skin and the fat literally off of her, but left it attached by the rectus muscle, which is the muscle that you see if anyone here has a six-pack. And he tunneled it underneath the chest skin up to where the breast had been a few hours earlier, and over the next couple of hours reconstructed a breast out of it. What an incredible thing that was. The woman had gone to sleep expecting a mastectomy and woke up with a brand new breast and tummy tuck. So, you know, I'd always been creative growing up. I had, you know, painted pictures when I was little, and doodles of mine ended up in my, you know, MTA yearbook. I worked on set design and building when I was at YU for the Dramatic Society. So I'd always been an artistic person. So this definitely appealed to me as a surgical specialty that I might want to go into. And I have actually. I naturally returned to YU, to Albert Einstein, to do my training in plastic surgery, and I've been a clinical professor of plastic surgery there since I graduated about 10 years ago. I have a private practice on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and in our office we have a whole surgery center. I've been there all day today doing plastic surgery, right in the office and in our operating room. The patients recover there and then they go home. Now, so that leaves us with the question, what is plastic surgery? Now, in today's day and age, I'm sure somebody's seen Extreme Makeover. That's sort of like plastic surgery, but a little less extreme than reality. Nip/tuck and Dr. 90210 are certainly not the reality of plastic surgery. Every plastic surgery lecture that I've ever gone to, an introductory lecture, starts with the same thing, and I'll start the same way. Plastic surgery was named from the Greek word plastikos, which means to form or to create. It has absolutely nothing to do with the material plastic, which was invented long after plastic surgery. So it has nothing to do with that. The first known plastic surgery, as far as plastic surgeons go, happened in the 1500s. There was a surgeon named Tagliacozzi, who's famous for all sorts of things in medicine. And Tagliacozzi reconstructed patients whose noses were cut off by the church for adultery. And he reconstructed it by attaching their arms to their faces. And it worked. Unfortunately, this was considered blasphemy. And after he was dead, they exhumed his body and the church shunned him. And he didn't become famous again until modern times, really. Modern plastic surgery was invented out of necessity after the World Wars, when lots of soldiers were coming back with parts missing or big open wounds that needed to be treated. So today, plastic surgery really gets divided all sorts of different ways. The flyer from today's for today's lectures says plastic and cosmetic. And with all due respect, that actually doesn't make any sense, because cosmetic surgery is part of plastic surgery. The way most people separate them is plastic and reconstructive surgery. Now, reconstructive surgery would be to take something abnormal and try to make it normal again, whereas cosmetic surgery would be to take something that's relatively normal and do something to improve upon it, shall we say. But as you will see, the line between cosmetic and reconstructive is very frequently blurred. A better way to look at plastic surgery, I think, is really to look at all the subspecialties within plastic surgery. Burn surgery, that's plastic surgery. Patients with major burns, small burns, whatever it is, large wounds, plastic surgeons take care of them right in the emergency room, and then over the next few months to maybe even years, they spend the time to reconstruct these people and try to make them relatively normal again. So that's certainly reconstructive surgery. Plastic surgeons are also the craniofacial surgeons, which means babies that are born with a cleft lip or a cleft palate or a misshapen skull, they can have 5 to 10 plastic surgery operations before they're 20 years old to try to make them normal again. In fact, my good friend David Staffenberg was in the newspapers a couple of years ago when he helped the neurosurgeons at Montefiore separate those twins who were attached at the head. Any New Yorkers know what I'm talking about. And those babies are all doing fine. And actually, the procedure that they developed is now being copied. They're getting ready to do the operation for the third time very shortly. So plastic surgeons are the craniofacial surgeons. And because of that, and because of the meticulousness involved, the truth is not a week goes by where I'm not called by an emergency room, a pediatrician, nervous parents who want their little kids sewn up only by a plastic surgeon because somebody cut their chin or their forehead. It happened last night. So plastic surgeons certainly do that part of craniofacial surgery. Plastic surgeons are also the microsurgeons, which means that plastic surgeons take care of tiny little arteries and tiny little veins where they do the surgery looking through a surgical microscope and doing the surgery down over here like you would with a video game, but using stitches that are finer than your hair to try to put something back together, arteries and nerves, etc. So if somebody's finger is cut off in an accident, plastic surgeon is the one that puts them back together. So plastic surgeons are also the hand surgeons. But microsurgery can also be used for reconstructive surgery, like what I was talking about before. If somebody's in a car accident and has a large wound on their leg where tissue is actually missing and the orthopedists have fixed the bones, but there's nothing to cover the bones, they'll call a plastic surgeon. And for example, we can take a muscle right off of someone's back, completely remove it, and then reattach it using the arteries and veins right down onto the leg and get that leg wound to heal. So plastic surgeons are the microsurgeons. And that microsurgery is also used for one of the newest operations out there, which is to do that same tummy tuck operation I talked about for breast reconstruction, but to literally remove the skin and fat from the body, leave the rectus muscles alone, leave their six-pack alone so they can keep doing their sit-ups, and then bring the breast tissue back up and reconstruct the breast tissue using what they call a free flap, using microsurgery. Now, that's a faster recovery and a better breast shape when the surgery is done. And then finally, plastic surgery is also cosmetic surgery. Surgery that is done purely on an elective basis to enhance, improve, fix, or rejuvenate some part of the body. Are Orthodox Jews allowed to do this? I hope so, considering the number of noses I've done on Orthodox people. And to be honest, a lot of other things that maybe they wouldn't want you to know that they did. And the truth is, if it isn't okay, am I allowed to do it? It's a question that's been asked. And hopefully Rabbi Weiss will tell us the answer. plastic surgery is very frequently called head-to-toe surgery because it's the only surgical subspecialty that really operates on every part of the body. No other surgical subspecialty does that. On the trunk of the body, we have liposuction and tummy tucks. And usually that's pretty cosmetic. If somebody comes in and they don't like that they've had a little too much on their outer thigh their whole life and they want that liposuctioned away, that's a procedure we do all the time. If somebody's had a bunch of kids and their stomach is stretched out with stretch marks or hanging, or their stomach muscles are really pulled apart and they want a tummy tuck, we flatten their stomachs for them again. And again, that's certainly usually cosmetic. But what about in today's day and age where the field of bariatric surgery is exploding? That's gastric bypasses, lap bands, where somebody who used to be 400 or 500 pounds is now coming into our office weighing 175 pounds. And all that skin that used to be out here is now hanging down to their knees. Patients come in, it's for the same tummy tuck operation, but is that cosmetic or is that reconstructive? And they also have it done for skin just literally hanging off their arms. You wouldn't actually believe what this looks like. Their arms, their breasts, their faces, their backs, their thighs, skin hanging everywhere. So again, is removing all of this skin cosmetic or is that reconstructive? And what about the chest? And I know we're at Stern, but let's talk about the guys first. A lot of guys come in with a symptom, let's say, called gynecomastia. And I'm not talking about somebody who's chubby, but gynecomastia is called feminizing breasts. So in other words, it's a guy who literally has a chest that may look like a woman. So there are procedures that we do for that. In the old days, insurance companies always said, oh, of course, we'll pay for that. That's, you know, a debilitating thing. But the truth is, it's very hard to get that covered nowadays for a person because even the insurance companies are considering that cosmetic. But for a guy who's suffering from that, he doesn't think so. And so he certainly would want that taken care of, either through a small incision and some liposuction, or a larger incision, which may leave scarring instead, but at least a person can still wear a t-shirt. As far as the women go, I'm sure you're all aware that breasts can be made larger. People go from an A or a B up to a C or a D. We do that surgery all the time. But what about the girl who is an A cup on one side and a C cup on the other? So she comes in and needs complicated surgery, maybe involving implants of two different sizes, maybe a reduction on one side and an implant on the other. It's actually a very difficult surgery to do, but is that cosmetic or is that reconstructive? For her, it has severe emotional and social consequences, but again, halakhically, is that really permissible? And again, on the opposite end of it, what about the woman who comes in who's a 42 triple H or something like that? She's carrying around a very large amount of weight, and I've seen it, who wants a breast reduction to really alleviate the pain in her back and her neck, and she walks stooped over, can't buy the right clothing, which may not be a halakhic issue, but wants a breast reduction. The truth is, in plastic surgery, those are absolutely the happiest patients by far. Breast reduction patient are in a whole class by themselves because you alleviate a problem right away on the day after surgery, and they're very, very happy. The pain is immediately gone. Now let's go back to breast cancer reconstruction for a moment. There are multiple different surgeries that we could do, not just the one I mentioned earlier. Firstly, after a complete or a partial mastectomy, let me just mention that a person can need chemotherapy. And for those that don't know, chemotherapy is literally giving someone medication that is going to go after any cancer cells that may have spread somewhere else in their body and kill them. These are the people that you see who have lost their hair because the chemotherapy usually kills the hair follicles at the same time. It's a very devastating thing, but again, some people have to go through it after the surgery. And other patients need radiation. Radiation is to kill any cancer that may have been left over somehow in the chest after the mastectomy was done. So a beam of radiation is literally shot at the person's chest, and that's what radiation treatment really is. And the question is, if chemo and radiation are needed after the mastectomy is done, can the breast reconstruction really be done? Should it be done? Because sometimes surgeries that are more complicated have more complications, wound infections, problems with the skin. That skin that you move from the belly up to the chest doesn't live. It turns black. Things can happen. So if it's possibly going to delay chemotherapy or radiation, halakhically, is it really permissible to even get involved with that in the first place? Now, some of the reconstructive options that I was going to mention are, first of all, after the mastectomy is done, you could simply put a tissue expander inside. It's like a balloon that goes underneath the skin. The skin gets closed over it, and then slowly, over a few months, a patient comes into my office, and we inflate that balloon right through the skin, and it expands the skin over time, and then when they get to the appropriate size, expand it a little further, and then another operation to take out that expander and put in a permanent breast implant. So that's the simplest kind of breast reconstruction surgery. The next kind of reconstruction is to use someone's own tissues. I mentioned that before. Taking skin from over here, bringing it over here. We can actually do it with the back fat and muscle from the fat and bring it to the front. If somebody's too skinny, we can do either of those surgeries in combination with a breast implant. So again, this is getting more and more complicated, and therefore adding 3 or even 6 hours of extra surgery may or may not be okay halakhically. And then again, what if there's a problem with the surgery and it delays the chemo or the radiation? So are you allowed to do this? And actually, forgetting about halakha, this is a conversation I have with every patient who's thinking about going through this. And we talk to their oncologist and say, is this somebody who needs chemotherapy right away? Or is this somebody who, if there's a problem, it'll be okay if they do their chemotherapy in a month? There's a difference. Finally, there's the breast surgery I told you about before, that microsurgery where you take another part of the body, and again, it could be the stomach, it could be a part of the behind, it could be a part of the back. You detach it from the body completely, and then over the next 6 to 12 hours, reattach it up at the chest with man-made connections for all the arteries and nerves. Now, again, man-made connections. What if those connections fail? That means that same person who just got out of a 12-hour operation goes back to the operating room that night, in the middle of the night. You don't wait. And you try to fix that connection and somehow make the thing work. And if it does, so now this person had 24 hours of operation, perhaps, and in a 36-hour period, the complication rate certainly goes up. So again, what if it delays the chemo? One last thought about breast reconstruction. None of the surgeries I mentioned need to be done at the time of the mastectomy. The mastectomy can take place. The person would be disfigured, like I said before. They go, they get their chemo, they get their radiation, and then after they're all done, they can come back and have a breast cancer reconstruction. And I still do that all the time, not only on patients who choose to do that now, but on patients who had mastectomies when they didn't have any other option and are wanting reconstruction now, 10 years later. Now they're doing the surgery at a later date. Now this breast that we're creating has absolutely no function whatsoever. It's made out of stomach fat. There's nothing there. So it's purely an aesthetic decision to be less disfigured, to hopefully feel whole again. But is it halakhically permissible at that time, at a late date, to just do this for the purposes of an aesthetic result? Again, we're going to wait for Rabbi Weiss to tell us the answer to that. But I will tell you, and this is not a halakhic source, but the federal government passed a law a few years ago that said that no matter what you need to do on a patient with breast cancer, you can keep taking them back to the operating room as many times as you want to try to do something to make that breast as normal as possible. And even if the new breast doesn't match the one they started with, maybe it's better. maybe it's a different size. You can do whatever you want to the non-cancer side to try to make the person as symmetric as possible. It's federal law that you need to be allowed to do that. But what does halacha think? Otherwise. Finally, to the head and neck. We do eye lifts, we do face lifts, we do brow lifts, we do neck lifts. People come in for skin peels, dermabrasion, hair transplants, laser treatments. And most of the time these are cosmetic. But what about the patient whose eyelids droop so badly that she can't see in one direction because her eyelids are in the way? I did that this afternoon. What about a little girl, 5 years old, whose ears are so misshapen, they stick out so far, that she goes to school and she's 5 years old, but people are starting to call her Dumbo, and that's actually considered the time to do the surgery before a kid starts first grade. So is that cosmetic? What about the patient who's paralyzed on one side of their face for whatever reason, and we do half a facelift to try to make them symmetric on the two sides? And of course, we certainly do nose jobs. Now, if someone has a deviated septum and can't breathe, I don't think there's any argument that that surgery is allowed, as similar as a gallbladder or any other surgery that somebody has. What if someone's nose is twisted because they fell or they got hit in the face with a basketball and their nose is broken? Well, fixing that broken nose is probably not even different than fixing a broken arm. But what if a year later it's still twisted and it still doesn't look right? Is it cosmetic at that point to try to straighten out somebody's nose? And to be honest, most of the time when we are treating a deviated septum or a fractured nose, the person does say, well, why are you there anyway? I never really like this bump on my nose. I hate my profile. The tip is a little too large. I just hate my nose. So that begs the question, nose job or no job? Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berger. That was really an excellent review of reconstructive and cosmetic surgery within plastic surgery. And I appreciate the opportunity for you to present. It certainly lightens my burden as well. And I learned a number of things and hope that maybe after I'm finished with my presentation, maybe you'll have some follow-up comments as well. We can go back and forth and back and forth and until Pesach, perhaps. By the way, just so you know, Kenny Brander and I, Rabbi Brander and I, were actually classmates in elementary school in Detroit. When his father, Rabbi Brander, had a position in Detroit, this goes back farther than we want to discuss at the moment. And I guess, not to age myself, but as you were talking, I was thinking about that show I used to watch all the time when I was a kid, The $6 Million Man. Which was, I guess, a form of plastic type of surgery. Just wanted to thank, first of all, the Center for the Jewish Future and the Torah Activities Council for sponsoring, and in particular the individuals who kind of put this together, Yonah Bardos and Chani Schoenbrunn, as well as Elisheva Levine, who's the president of the Medical Ethics Society here at Stern, and Yonah is the president uptown. Thank you for inviting me. I want to thank also my good friend Rabbi Dr. Reifman for also initiating this offer to me, and I appreciate the opportunity always to speak. I enjoy very much teaching at Stern College. It's to me it's very important. I have a full-time job as a rabbi, and this is for me a very important part of my weekly activities, and sometimes I wish I could give more attention and time to the students, but my full-time job as well as making a parnasa, kind of forbid that at this time. So I wanted to kind of begin with just a little anecdote, just kind of ease things from your presentation to mine, and then come back more seriously. The story goes, maybe you've heard, that this surgeon, after 120 years, goes up to heaven. And he's standing in line with his surgical scrubs and his stethoscope around the neck. Of course, the internist would ask, what does a surgeon need a stethoscope for? But when I was in medical school, the surgeons made fun of the internist, the internist made fun of the surgeon, and they all made fun of psychiatrists. And the truth is that what we're discussing today really spans all three of those disciplines, medical, surgical, and psychosocial and psychiatric, and so all disciplines are really, really very essential, and all that is truly just in jest. But the story goes that the surgeon goes up to heaven after 120 years, and he's standing in line to get into the cafeteria. And he goes to the head of line and says, I was a very prominent cardiothoracic surgeon here on Earth, and I think it really is appropriate to me, befitting that I should be able to go ahead of line. So the angel there in charge says, I'm sorry, doctor, but here in heaven everyone is equal. You have to go back to the end of the line. So time goes on and on, very slow line, getting into the cafeteria in heaven. And at one point, the surgeon looks up and he sees this other physician, also with surgical scrubs, wearing a white coat and a stethoscope, goes to the head of line, everyone moves out of the way, he goes right in. So now this cardiothoracic surgeon is really fuming. Goes back to the other line to the angel and says, what just happened? You just told me everybody here is equal. Why did that surgeon go into the cafeteria head? Why is he different? So the angel turns to the physician and says, him? That's no doctor, that's God. He just likes to play doctor. So the truth is that we like to play doctor and we like to perhaps play God, and you alluded to that in your presentation in terms of whether or not one is permitted to engage in these activities. So just wanted to kind of give an overview and then some specific discussions regarding this issue and come to perhaps some conclusions, maybe not all, this evening. In Jewish medical halacha, as well as in general bioethics and the general secular field, one always starts, as Dr. Berger so comprehensively discussed, with talking about the clinical facts. Before one can discuss ethics or halacha, one has to know and be familiar with the clinical facts. In addition to that, one then has to, in any situation, particularly in situations dealing with end of life, but also in situations like cosmetic and reconstructive surgery, also be sensitive to the interests and wishes of the patient. In Jewish medical ethics, not that it doesn't exist in secular ethics, but more so, there's a focus also on the duties, responsibilities, and limitations of the physician. In general bioethics, there's a great focus around the patient. The patient is, in many ways, the focal point of bioethics. In halacha, everyone involved really serve individually and collectively as a nidus of focus in terms of what the interests are. And as a physician, one has responsibility to a patient, but also has responsibilities to a halacha, and a patient has responsibilities to him or herself, as well as to the physician, but also to a halacha. And so when we discuss some of these issues, there are issues that kind of overlap, but are somewhat individualized between healthcare provider and recipient. We're going to focus perhaps more so on the patient. Some of what we're going to describe certainly is relevant for the physician as well. And what is necessarily permitted for the patient certainly reflects that which is permissible for the physician in general. So I want to start discussing some of the issues. I want to begin really by introducing to you a book that you may be familiar with. It is the basis of Jewish bioethics as we know it in the 20th century and beyond. Who the father of general bioethics is a debate, perhaps, amongst the academicians, but we know for sure who the father of Jewish medical ethics is, and that was Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz. Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz was born in Ireland. He served as a rabbi here in New York. He was the founding rabbi of Fifth Avenue Synagogue, where I had the privilege of serving as an assistant rabbi many years later. He also eventually became the chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth and was knighted by the Queen, hence Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz. Passed away just a number of years ago. I actually had the privilege of hearing him in person and meeting him one time in a conference in San Francisco. He wasn't feeling well one Friday afternoon, and so they asked if there were any doctors around, so we went up to see how he was doing. He and his wife had been out together the night before. It was a very, very lovely couple. He passed away a number of years ago, but he is without doubt, and if any of you are interested in Jewish medical ethics, this is a book that you must own, you must read. It is not just historical, though it began with his writing of his PhD thesis at the University of London in 1955. It is not outdated. First of all, he updated some things in the 1970s, I believe, but Needless to say, there are a lot of things that were not updated since then. It still is considered to be, certainly by myself and others as well, I'm sure, one of the most fundamental, one of the most well-written and researched books, Jewish Medical Ethics, Emanuel Jacobowitz. And in there, he already began to discuss issues that others have certainly followed suit. So I just want to read to you just briefly. He has just one little page regarding cosmetic surgery. I want to read that to you and then expand upon that. He says, the moral questioning aroused by the increasingly popular recourse to plastic surgery for purely cosmetic purposes has lately found some rabbinical echoes too. He talks about a paper that he presented in 1961 to the American Society of Facial Plastic Surgery. And he talks about the various topics, and he subcategorizes it. He's very systematic, very well organized, really meticulous. It's a must book if you're interested in Jewish medical ethics. So he writes, the problem was considered under four headings. These were his presentations, and I'm going to read to you from some of his writings in Hebrew on the topic. Number one is the theological implications of, quote-unquote, improving God's works, or, quote-unquote, flying in the face of providence. It's a nice term, flying in the face of providence. The second is the possible risks to life involved in any operation. The third, the Jewish objection to any mutilation of the body, known in halacha based on psukim of his chavala, mutilation of someone else as well as self-mutilation. Both are considered to be isurim deraisa, biblical prohibitions. I'm not permitted to mutilate another person. I'm not permitted to allow another person to mutilate me. I'm not allowed to mutilate myself. These are considered to be isurim deraisa, biblical prohibitions. And number four, the ethical censure of human vanity, especially among males. But the first three are the primary ones, the theological implications of improving God's work, possible risks to life, and the issue of mutilation of someone else, as well as self-mutilation. So I'd like to read to you some discussions in the literature. These discussions really date back many, many years. One of the very fine journals that the college owns is called Noam. Noam is a very, very sophisticated halachic journal that's put out in Eretz Yisrael. A number of very important articles have appeared over the course of decades in Noam, and there are a number of discussions in Noam over the years regarding the issue of plastic surgery. So I'd like to read just two short descriptions and then expand upon that. This comes from Noam. This was compiled by Rabbi Yitzchak Yehuda Hershkowitz. So, she'ela, the question is the following. Isha she'esh lo mum chitzoni, a woman who has some kind of external, imperfect kind of presentation, some kind of blemish, some kind of disfigurement. Hayem mutter lo lasos nituach plasti, l'shem yofi ba'alma. Is it permissible for her to perform? It's interesting to note the formulation of the question. Is it permissible for her to perform? She's not going to perform anything. She's not going to perform surgery on herself. That would be a very gifted student. She's not going to perform surgery on herself. She's going to be the subject of surgery. But nonetheless, it's phrased in the as if she herself is performing the surgery, which means, just implicit in the question, is the equation between the physician, the healthcare provider, and the recipient, as if they're kind of blurred as one individual, and what's permitted for one is permitted for the other, what's usher for one is usher for the other. So he writes, is it permissible? L'shem yofi ba'alma, just for purposes of improvement, beautification, enhancement of appearance. V'lo amrinan, and maybe we don't say, shehim is takena shelo litzarach, that she's endangering herself because of complications, some of which Dr. Berger referred to, issues of infections, other issues that are complications of the surgery directly or ancillary complications, issues related to anesthesia. That's one question perhaps Dr. Berger can come back and discuss, the issues related to anesthesia. There are two types of anesthesia, or generally two types of anesthesia that might be used in any given patient, general anesthesia and local anesthesia. Clearly, general anesthesia carries a higher risk to the patient of morbidity and potential mortality, morbidity complications that are not necessarily life-threatening, mortality, those which are life-threatening and do cause loss of life, as opposed to local anesthetics, which are clearly less morbid and less likely to cause mortality. So the question is she permitted to engage in something that endangers herself, both by virtue of the surgery itself that could create complications, as well as the anesthesia that may be used, particularly if it's general anesthesia. And one thing hopefully Dr. Berg will come back and discuss, what kinds of anesthesia are commonly used and what the risks are. Generally speaking, Dr. Berger can affirm the risks generally today in 2007 are relatively low, both from anesthesia as well as from the surgical procedures itself. The numbers approximately in terms of general anesthesia are less than 1% risk of serious complication. But there is a risk. It's not zero, it's not negligible, it's not nil. There is some kind of risk, but extremely, extremely low and extremely infrequent. So is it permitted for her to do so, L'shem Yofi Balma, just for self-improvement of appearance, when she will be endangering her own life, potentially, for shelo l'tzorach, not for a purpose? Again, included in that phraseology, just of the question, before you come to the answer, is an implication that a person is permitted to enter into a dangerous situation if it's l'tzorach, if there's some practical benefit. The question is this considered to be a practical benefit? General surgery does it all the time. Every surgery carries with it certain risks, but there's a tzorach to remove a gallbladder. That sometimes it's for a life-threatening situation, sometimes it's not for a life-threatening, but to alleviate pain and discomfort, surgeries are done all the time for that, and that's considered to be litzoref. That's for certainly a definitive benefit to the patient. Is this considered the definitive benefit where it's not designed to really cure a condition? V'chein gever, then he talks a little bit about a man. Is a man permitted to engage in plastic surgery? Ho'yimim bozei yisr mishlam lo yilbash. Gever simlas isha, that perhaps for a man to be focused on his appearance and engage in a cosmetic surgery, that might be a violation of l'yilbash gever simlas isha. Just had Purim not long ago, although it's just about Pesach. But there's a whole discussion Shulchan Aruch about, because there's a minhag that's on Purim that men dress up as women, women dress up as men, or children dress up in the opposite gender. There's a whole discussion in Shulchan Aruch about l'yilbash gever, that copying the other gender. So that's the discussion regarding men. I'm going to leave men aside. So the tshuva that he quotes very briefly, Yesh Lahatir, says, I think it's permissible. Just saved your practice. Feel Yesh Lahatir. Kimaisim b'chol yom, sh'osim tuach kozeh. So it's interesting to think, we'll focus on this short logic. Because these are everyday occurrences. And therefore implied in that is the notion that risks that are undertaken by people on a regular basis every day are not risks that rise to a threshold that would be problematic halachically. These are everyday risks that people are willing to take, and therefore the risk is considered to be halachically not significant. That's the idea that's being presented. And people don't end up having serious complications. Sometimes it happens, but it's ma'isim b'chol yom, sh'vein b'yim l'chlal sakana. They don't come. I don't think he means that, meaning there are no complications, meaning that the likelihood is so low. So when, number one, the risks of serious complications are relatively low, like less than 1%, for example, which is a relatively low risk factor, and this is something that people commonly do and accept that level of risk, so that itself mitigates perhaps the issue of entering into sakana. It's important to clarify that there won't be real sakana. Again, does it mean no sakana? Probably means very little. That's my interpretation. Maybe that's not what he means. Then he writes regarding men. Is it permissible? So he says, you follow minhag hamedina. Is this something that men normally do? In terms of defining lo yubash gever, you have to look at what the norm is in that society. If it's the norm for that society to engage in this kind of practice, then maybe it's not a violation of adopting the opposite gender's practice. So that's just a brief discussion. A little bit more of an expanded discussion, also found in Noam, and it's in this particular presentation, Rav Chanoch Zundel Grossberg, is ha'im mutter lasos mituach plasti, in situations of complications that developed or disfigurement that occurred because of disease, not because of yipui ba'alma, that a person wants a cosmetic surgery that wasn't caused by disfigurement due to some kind of illness, whether it was due to another surgical procedure or some other accident. But this particular case talks about but it's not necessary for the person's recovery. The person will recover from, for example, the cancer of the breast with or without the reconstructive surgery. So it's not medically indicated in terms of the disease process. What's medically indicated in terms of the disease process was the mastectomy to remove the blast, perhaps with follow-up radiation, perhaps with follow-up chemo, whatever the follow-up may be. But the reconstructive surgery is not mechutz lerefuah. It's not necessary for recovery from the illness. Elishem yofi baum, it's for enhancement of appearance that was caused by an illness. It wasn't what one was born with naturally, so it's not a cosmetic surgery. It's a reconstructive surgery, as Dr. Berger explained. Maybe again, it's self-mutilation or subjecting oneself to being mutilated by a physician who maybe doesn't have a license halakhically to mutilate another person without that, even with that person's consent. One important difference between general bioethics and Jewish medical ethics is that in general bioethics, one of the most important, perhaps the most important, but that's debatable, one of the most important principles is autonomy and self-determination, which was a federal enactment in 1991, where a person has the right to accept or refuse treatment without having to explain any rationales to anyone. A person has the right to simply refuse a treatment or to simply pursue a treatment, up to a point pursuing a treatment, leaving out issues of futility, but in terms of refusing a treatment, in terms of deciding self-determination, autonomy, a person is the center of healthcare decisions. In halacha, we believe in autonomy, we believe in self-determination, but there are limitations. There are also obligations that a person has to halacha, and therefore a person can't just wantonly decide what will or will not happen to that person medically. So he writes that this particular case is their problem of self-mutilation or endangering. So he writes, "Kivin shosim asanatuach lo rak kedei lisanos ba'am." Well, this surgery is not done just for the purpose of beautification. Elashem hasoras habusha machmas hakiur. It's to remove a psychosocial issue. A person who is truly uncomfortable, is not comfortable with herself, not comfortable interacting with other people, maybe one's spouse, maybe other people in general, maybe being in public. That kind of busha, that kind of discomfort, a psychosocial discomfort, not a physical discomfort, itself is considered to be ein zeh shelo l'tzarach. That's not needless, that's not for no purpose. That itself is an indication, a bona fide indication, when a woman or a man, in the case of gynecomastia, where a man has an enlarged breast, that's not just the yipui ba'alma, just for purposes of enhancement. That's not augmentation. That's not aesthetic. That's for purposes of removing a serious, understandable, real human concern about busha, about being uncomfortable due to an illness that the person has, due to whatever the accident may have been. Ein zeh shelo l'tzarach. And it's not considered to be mutilation, because mutilation means that one hurts oneself. If one performs surgery to improve and better oneself, then by definition that's not chaval. We're going to expand upon this as we continue on to develop the idea. I want to now switch over to a more elaborate discussion by Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobitz in his Hebrew presentation regarding the issue. He talks about specifically reconstructive surgery, but we're going to mix in some of the issues relating to cosmetic as well. He talks about reconstructive surgery. And in reconstructive surgery, as he discussed in his English presentation, here too he outlines the issues in Hebrew. It's permissible for a person to create a situation of potential hazard. Number one. Number two, is it permissible for a person to mutilate himself or herself or allow someone else to do so? And number three, is it nachon, is it appropriate, the sakein ulehetiv, to improve and to better yitziras hatzayor, to improve the creation, the form. I refer to the Greek term plastikos, that means to form. So the concept that he's suggesting is that God is the tzayor, God is the ultimate plastic surgeon, and as such, he formed all of us with all of our physical features. And if I try to improve upon mine, am I not contravening that which he did? Am I not objecting? Am I not insulting him, in a sense? So is it permissible to do so? Because Hatsur Tamim Paolo, Hatsur, the craftsman, the artisan, his work is perfect. And to improve upon that would be perhaps considered to be blasphemous. Isn't that contradicting the Gzer of the king? So in his discussion, he writes the following. He has a number of very fascinating points. He was truly, truly ahead of his time. It's just the father of Jewish medical ethics, Rabbi Jacoba, is just an amazing individual. Following him, there have been a number, Dr. Rosner, Dr. Abraham, Dr. Steinberg, others as well, some of the young people that Dr. Berger referred to, Rabbi Brander, Dr. Reichman, but Rabbi Jacobowitz began it all, and without him, we would probably be nowhere. So Rabbi Jacobowitz writes the following, Osir Laudam Lasakinus Asmo, that's a din in Shulchan Aruch, he quotes the Ramah in Yoredeya, it is prohibited for a person to enter into dangerous situations, to endanger oneself. That's an Isser, I'm not permitted to put myself into danger. But he points out, B'chozos, nearly Shiesh Mikrim, there are situations where a person is permitted to endanger oneself. Proof of it being Birchas HaGomel. Gemara talks about Birchas HaGomel based on four scenarios, based on Psukim and Tehillim, where a person recites Birchas HaGomel expressing gratitude for God for having survived a particularly hazardous situation. And what, pray tell, was the person doing in these dangerous situations? Was it accidental? No, it was not. Some of it may have been. Some of it may have been coerced. But one example is a person who went overseas, and traveling the seas, certainly Bisman HaGemara, was something that was considered to be hazardous. So traveling the seas, or traveling through the Midbarios, through the deserts. And why was the person traveling? Because the person's Parnassa was there on the other side of the ocean, or the other side of the desert. So the person was going to make a living. So for the purposes of making a living, I'm allowed to enter into dangerous situations? Answer is yes, says Rabbi Jacobowitz, proof being that there's a bracha recited when the person comes back, meaning that I'm allowed to enter into these dangerous situations for purposes of litzorech. Tzorech means I need to make a parnosa. I can't find another job here. I can't find a local job. I have to go overseas. I have to go all the way through the desert. So the answer is not necessarily, but if that's what I do, or that's what I found, or that's what came across, that's what God presented, gave me the opportunity to do. So I'm not necessarily obliged to insist that I must find work here. I'm permitted to enter into a certain level of danger and then say gomel afterwards. So clearly says Jacobowitz that there are sakonos that a person is permitted to accept and undertake. And therefore, litzorech. So he says, well, then maybe one can make the same argument here again. That even though the person is entering into a certain level of danger, let's assume that percentage, less than 1% danger of serious complication from the anesthesia, and the percentages from the surgery itself, I'll leave to Dr. Berger perhaps to elaborate upon it, if you don't mind. Whatever those are, they're small percentages, but they are real. They're small, but real. They used to always tell us in medical school that, you know, the one person out of 50,000 who has that complication 100%. So it's not as if the complications don't exist. It's not like it's bottled b'shishim, it doesn't exist. It's a different din. So you can't just kosher it away. So, but nonetheless, a person is permitted to engage in certain risky procedures for purposes of litzorech, even though it's not going to make any difference in the outcome of the cancer, but engaging in the reconstructive surgery of the mastectomy for purposes of litzorech to remove, in conjunction with what we just mentioned a few moments ago, the busha, the psychosocial discomfort that a woman or a man may feel and undergo, that itself is considered to be bona fide enough to permit one to enter into these dangerous situations. And it may be, one may suggest, that I don't know if I have not searched the literature to see whether or not there are better long-term outcomes in women who undergo mastectomy with follow-up, who have had proper and satisfying reconstructive surgery versus those who have not, in terms of the overall mood, in terms of depression, in terms of being able to fight the cancer more vigorously from within. I don't know, maybe there are studies, I'm not familiar, I have not searched for that, but that's something not to be taken lightly as well. But even that aside, that's point number one. So certainly the sakon is considered to be not significant enough and able to be accepted by the person, certainly for reconstructive surgeries. Regarding the issue of chavalah, of self-mutilation, so here he's a little bit less comfortable, allowing chavalah. He talks about various multiple surgeries, so he's not so convinced that it is. So he says that maybe cholzos mutter, nonetheless his conclusion is that it's mutter, based on an idea of the Ramban. Now, with this I'd like to shift and share with you a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe has one of the important tshuvas regarding cosmetic surgery. It can be applied, the principles, to reconstructive, but I just want to clarify that we're now shifting from reconstructive to purely cosmetic. Rav Moshe's question that was asked in Choshen Mishpat was Im Nara Muteris Liafos Atzmo Alidin Shuach Shuhu Chavol Begufa. Is a young woman permitted to enhance her appearance through surgery that is mutilating to her body. Namely, it's chavola halachically, perhaps, not in terms of outcome. Nishalti b'narosh roseli afosas makdeshi yipkitsu aleho lekadsho. The woman wants to enhance her appearance. It doesn't present here that she had any disfigurement from any illness or any accident. That's not the way it's presented. It doesn't specifically specify what the situation was. It just seems to kind of generically talk about a woman who was simply not comfortable with the way that she looked and felt that this was impeding her ability socially and her ability to perhaps find a proper shidduch. So therefore, she wanted to improve herself. So before I continue Rav Moshe's tshuva, I just want to read something which I think is very important. I'd like to know Dr. Berger's opinion and experience of it as well. This comes from one of the textbooks on plastic reconstructive surgery. Quote, cosmetic changes in appearance will generally not save a failing marriage, help to procure a new job, or substantially improve a person's station in life. And persons with such expectations should not undergo aesthetic or cosmetic surgery. The point being that one has to have realistic expectations. One has to understand what other issues may be impeding a person's ability to move on in life, whether it be socially, whether it be economically, professionally, or otherwise. And in conjunction with a comprehensive approach to one's life, being comfortable with oneself and perhaps enhancing one's appearance as well, one has to not view the cosmetic surgery as the all and all complete answer. The ideal candidate, they write, for cosmetic surgery is an adult or mature teenager who has a realistic idea of what is to be accomplished, is not under pressure from others to have the operation, and does not expect major changes in interpersonal relations or career potential following surgery. That having been said, let's return to Rav Moshe's tshuva. Rav Moshe talks about, is a woman permitted to undergo this situation, when he addresses the issue of chavala, of mutilation. So he says, well, goes back and forth, he discusses, Rav Moshe's tshuvas are always fascinating. I remember when I was in YU, so I learned many years with Rav Schechter Shlita. So many of you have heard Rav Schechter speak here, I think, at Stern College and elsewhere. So you're familiar with his expertise. So I remember he used to describe to us that he would, when he was learning Yerideya, he would kind of test himself. Maybe some of the other students at the time would do the same. They would test themselves by looking at some of the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, looking at what the Shaila was, and trying to figure out what their answers, and then comparing it to what Rav Moshe had. And he used to tell us that he used to come up with whatever conclusions. He looked at Rav Moshe, it was totally different. So he was kind of expressing the greatness of Rav Moshe, how Rav Moshe had a view and an approach that one was not necessarily able to anticipate so easily. So Rav Moshe has a long discussion. The most important point that Rav Moshe writes is based on the Rambam. The Rambam writes in the laws of Chavel Urotzeach, the Rambam writes that the prohibition to mutilate another individual or oneself is only, says the Rambam, shehumamaka derech nitzayon, that a person insults, physically assaults another person, derech nitzayon. Derech nitzayon can be translated in a malicious, violent, assaulting, aggravating way. Derech nitzayon, a malicious, assaulting, aggravating way. Derech nitzayon. So Rav Moshe writes, so is this derech nitzayon when the surgeon perhaps performs a rhinoplasty for purposes of enhancing one's appearance of the nose based on whatever the issue was, asymmetry or something that existed? Is that physician doing something derech nitzayon? Is he or she doing it maliciously or in an aggravated, assaulting way? No, says Rav Moshe, the person is doing it clearly le'afosa, to help her, to improve, to enhance. So it's not a denigrating, assaulting, aggravated way. And therefore he writes, so it's not also based on that. And that's why his conclusion is, Moshe's conclusion is, that that I think it's permissible for the young woman to have this enhancement, even though it's through mutilation, because of the idea of the Rambam that it's really not defined as mutilation, since it's letovasa. Then he quotes what Rabbi Kovitz referred to, namely the idea, quoting a Rashi, the concept of Lo Huzaru Yisrael Milasos Lechavereim Lodover Shein Chavis Lasos Asma, based on the pasuk of Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha. It's an idea that the Ramban has, and Rashi explains as well that he quotes from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha means that, as Ramosha explains, Kavanas Rashi Hu Shehu L'Tavaso Shkol Adam Rotzim B'Chavetzim Lasos La'Atzim Tzadu Abu La'Atzma. After Reacha Kamocha means that just like out of my love for myself I would want to have something done for me, so too I should want to do it for someone else. So Ramosha writes, out of love for myself I would want my nose to be improved, and therefore, out of love for someone else, I'm permitted to do that for the other person as well, based on V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, which is incorporated in the sense of that idea that chavala is only prohibited if it's mutilating, if it's designed to be assaulting, malicious, and hurtful, rather than designed to be l'tovaso, or l'tovasa, out of the concept that I would do it to myself, out of love for myself. It's assumed that every person loves him or herself, and if I would do it for myself, I would do it for someone else as well. So that's the idea that Moshe writes regarding cosmetic surgery. Rav Jacobowitz quotes it in the context of reconstructive surgery, but if Moshe applies it to cosmetics, certainly so for reconstructive. The third issue regarding, is it appropriate to kind of contravene that which God did? So I want to digress again for a moment and share with you two Jews of Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. Tzitz Eliezer passed away just, what, maybe 2 months ago or so? Wrote a whole series of responses called Shalos and Shuvas Tzitz Eliezer. He's one of the major rabbanim in Yerushalayim. I had the privilege of meeting him many, many years ago when I was in Israel with my parents once for Pesach. So I went, because I heard Tzitz Eliezer is known here in America as one of the great poskim in medical halacha. He has loads and loads of tshuvas. He talks about all kinds of issues. So I went to see him. I went to visit him. He lived in this very, very modest, small, little apartment near the old Shaar HaTzedek Hospital. So it was before Pesach. So I wanted to. I had met with him. He set me down. He offered me some grape juice. He asked me if I own his svarim, which I do not. And I use them wherever I find them, whatever. The library has them here. They have them in the shul. So I don't. They're like 20 volumes or so. I remember I wanted to give him something before Pesach. I saw he lived so much. I wanted to just leave him a few American dollars or something. So I don't think he understood what I wanted to do. And he kind of said, no, there was a young Israeli woman who was helping them clean for Pesach. He said, give it to her. She can use it. So Tzitz Eliezer has some very important shuvas. There was a major dispute between himself and Rav Moshe Feinstein regarding issues of abortion. And some very important shuvas. So he has some two interesting shuvas I wanted to share with you. First one is a very fascinating tshuva regarding, like Dr. Berger talked about, the reattachment procedure. The situation that was presented to him actually by Dr. Abraham was a question about a Kohen. A Kohen who, through some kind of accident, had one finger severed. And the shaila, this is the shaila, it's an amazing shaila. The shaila was, is it permissible to reattach that finger? What's the shaila? Shaila is, well, he's a Kohen. So until the reattachment occurs, he will be in the same room and be in contact with an aver, a limb, which is metame, which detached is considered to be something that conveys and confers tumma, metaphysical impurity upon the Kohen. That was the Shaila. So Tzitz Eliezer concludes that it's permissible, reconstructive surgery, for reasons that he goes into, which I don't need to go into right now, based on ideas they're relative, relevant, but not immediately relevant. Just wanted to present that to you. In contrast to that, Rav Waldenberg has another tshuva, where he is particularly stringent and not very, if you will, open. I don't mean this open in terms of halakhic analysis, to considering allowing cosmetic surgery. His opinion is that cosmetic surgery, in contrast to Rav Moshe, is prohibited. So he writes, regarding this issue, Yesh Ledati talks about nituchim plastiyim, plastic surgery. He specifically talks about the shem yifui eboreim, ve'en shum machlokoiv, without any pre-existing illness or injury or trauma, just cosmetic surgery. So he talks about the issue. He talks about this idea of Yesh Ledas ulahamin. It's important for the person to recognize and to believe. Ki ein tzayor kelokenu. Ein tzur kelokenu, ein tzayor kelokenu. There's no artisan like our God. That God imprinted and indoctrinated, in a sense, in every individual the shape, the form that's appropriate for him or her. And a person has no right to augment or to reduce, in a sense. Then he talks about the specific issues, and he develops the following idea. There is a whole discussion in the Gemara about how it is that the physician has a license in general to heal. Isn't that contravening God's will? If God strikes someone, God forbid, with an illness, so why shouldn't we assume that that's God's will, and what right do we have to interfere? So Gemara says we're not supposed to think that way. Rapo yirape, shnim kanshin, rishus l'rofe l'rapos. The physician has a license to heal, and you don't say, Hashem mache yameisi, so how am I allowed to do so? It's not so. I'm supposed to do whatever I'm supposed to do. God does what he does, but I'm obligated to help people. I'm obligated to cure and to help and to improve in the world, so on and so forth. So says Rav Waldenberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the license to heal and to perform surgery, and we refer to the federal law before about performing cosmetic surgery or reconstructive surgery on the non-affected breast. So Rav Waldenberg claims that the license of the Torah to heal only applies in situations of illness, where the pasuk that the Gemara quotes in Sanhedrin, Vashevosolo, that you're obligated to restore one's life to someone or restore one's health to someone, is when a person lost something, lost one's health, and I'm obligated to restore it. And we don't say, well, God caused it to happen, so I'm not supposed to get involved. No, I have my own obligations. God runs his world the way he wants to, but I have obligations from the Torah to help people and to restore things to people that they have lost. But says Revolver, that's only if somebody lost something. If a person didn't lose something, a person wasn't in an accident, a person didn't suffer from a debilitating or disfiguring cancer or from a surgical procedure or something that caused it from an illness, then they haven't lost anything. If they were born with this structure of the nose or whatever the particular presentation appearance may be, then that person has never lost something. Therefore, I don't have a license to restore it because it's never been lost. And therefore, we revert back to the din that what right do I have to interfere with God's work? And therefore, he considers cosmetic surgery for purely aesthetic reasons without any pre-existing illness considered to be prohibited. And he writes, a person shouldn't try to outsmart himself, lishanos hateva, to change nature. And therefore he considered Alkein Nira la Halacha, Kiniskileel, the Osir Lo La Adam Laso Slo Nituah Plasti, is forbidden to perform cosmetic surgery. The Khen Rofe, Vatsian Tuhzen, it's prohibited for the patient to be recipient, and it's prohibited for the physician to perform the Shem Yofi Ba'amo. That's his opinion. So in contrast to that, Ramosha clearly is of the opinion otherwise. But in terms of going back now to complete the story with Rav Jacobowitz regarding this idea of interfering and intervening in God's work, he writes that you find that there is a mandate by the Torah. In a sense, maybe that's included in what Rav Soloveitchik used to discuss, I believe, b'chivshuha, that we have an obligation to conquer the world, to master it, to improve it, tikkun ha'olam, in a larger sense. And as a result, he writes that there is a mandate upon people to improve the ma'aseh bereishis, that we shouldn't assume that the way God created the world must stay exactly this way, that we're not allowed to introduce technologies or improvements, that we're supposed to use what God gave us, the raw materials, and use those to improve upon, and therefore, maybe that would include also the figure of the human beings to enhance. But the purpose being to enhance the person's own psychosocial health, self-confidence, self-worth, self-image as well. And as such, that would be considered to be the basis for the heter. And as that article, what I quoted before, comes from, that a person has to have a realistic notion of what is and what isn't considered to be appropriate. So with that, I'd like to maybe then just review a few points that Dr. Berger referred to the questions about, and then ask him perhaps follow up after that if we still have time for a few more minutes. Not that much more time. So to answer the basic questions, it seems fairly clear. First of all, I do want to say at the outset as a disclaimer that I'm not here to paskin any specific shilas. Any specific shilas should be discussed with the privately and individually with the Rav. I'm just here to present some of the issues so one has the knowledge, then informed consent to discuss it appropriately any given time, whatever the situation may be, for men or women. And so number one, in terms of reconstructive surgery, that seems to be overwhelming support for that based on the ideas that we presented. It's not considered to be endangering because people do it on a regular basis. It's, the risk is relatively low, and a person is permitted to endanger oneself to a certain point for a beneficial concrete reason. Not chavala for remotious reasons. It's not assaulting. It's not malicious. And it's not contravening God's will, because this is part of what we do all the time, improving in God's world and taking advantage of the raw materials and taking advantage of the knowledge that He gives us. In terms of purely cosmetic surgery, clearly there's a machlokas between Reb Moshe and between Reb Waldenberg. It is interesting to note that Reb Shkopowitz, in his conclusion of his article, writes that he tends to believe that there may be a distinction as well between reconstructive and purely cosmetic, and therefore one has to, again, always address it in an individual basis and see what the real situation is. Reb Moshe was sensitive to that, the psychosocial needs of an individual. In terms of the issue of delaying chemotherapy, correct me if I'm wrong, if the basic, because one question I wanted to ask you was the differences and how often and the risks between immediate reconstructive surgery versus delayed reconstructive surgery or staged at more than one surgery. And in terms of delaying chemotherapy, well, clearly that would largely be based on a medical decision. Namely, if the likelihood is that normally the reconstructive surgery doesn't result in any significant delay that's clinically significant, the person would have the right to undergo it immediately, since there are some benefits to doing it immediately. If there's a question or any possibility of delaying it or any risk, so again, that enters into the question of how much risk is a person allowed to undertake and what the risks of delaying it are. So we'd have to work out some of the statistics a little bit. If I can ask you to just discuss a little bit now the risks of the surgery itself, difference between this immediate and the delayed or staged, and that would, I think, kind of address some of the issues. And then I don't know if there would be any more time for questions. Otherwise, I thank all of you for your attentiveness, and again for the program coordinators. Thank you very much. Okay.
I made some notes just briefly about some of the questions that you wanted to ask me, but I'm happy that nearly every question I ask keeps me in business and lets me continue doing what I'm doing, except for Reb Waldenberg, who also said, I think you mentioned this, that you can't even be a plastic surgeon, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I believe that. It says that also. But I like Reb Moshe better. Going backwards from the different things you asked me to address, first of all, in terms of delaying the chemo, absolutely is it a medical decision, because, like I said before, whenever someone is going to have breast reconstruction, there are a lot of people involved. You've got the general surgeon, you've got their oncologist, you've got the patient, certainly, and you've got the plastic surgeon. Sometimes there are even more specialties involved trying to put it all together. They have meetings sometimes with 20 people there trying to figure out what to do with the patient. So usually when someone can't have a reconstruction right away, it's not the decision of the plastic surgeon or the general surgeon. It's the oncologist saying, just get this done. Do something simple, get it done, including even if you do nothing. And sometimes they'll say, okay, put in a tissue expander, that simple operation I said before, because you can just get that done quickly, and the healing from that is very quickly, and then she can get on to whatever adjuvant therapy, chemo and radiation, she needs to do. So that's the answer to that question, I think. And sometimes you're wrong. I mean, that's really the answer to everything that we talked about. Anesthesiologists in general, you know, always talk to patients before surgery, and everybody's worried about the anesthesia. And the statistics are that anesthesia given by a board-certified anesthesiologist is very safe. Now, there's a third kind of anesthesia in the middle, which is not local, which is on an awake person getting needles put into them for local anesthesia, like you would at a dentist, and not general anesthesia, but somewhere in the middle, sedation, where they give medication to the patient falls asleep, and then you give all the local anesthesia while they're sleeping. And you can wake them up or not wake them up, it doesn't matter. So, personally, I know that from the anesthesiologist's perspective, they always quote actually what we, if you think about it, benched Gomel about for years. When I was a kid, anybody that went to Israel always benched Gomel. Now think about it, how many times you hear Gomel and Shul for somebody going to Israel. So as time goes on, things become perhaps safer, and therefore the risk to doing it becomes less, and people stop benching Gomel for this particular thing. And the truth is, we do assume risk in a lot of what we do. If we're going to Florida for winter break, we're not going there for Parnassa reasons, which is what was discussed, like you mentioned earlier, traveling across the sea. We're taking a risk. We're going up in a metal machine and flying, but you're allowed to do that. Why are you allowed to do that? You're not going for any reason except to get a suntan, which you shouldn't do. But we do take risks in our lives, and we're allowed to able to continue our life in a way that is just part of normal life activities. And cosmetic surgery nowadays really is part of normal life activity. As far as anesthesia goes, the anesthesiologists themselves quote airplane rides all the time and say that statistically, anesthesia is safer than going on an airplane. So if anesthesia is really that safe, and certainly you wouldn't think twice about going on an airplane, there's no reason not to have general anesthesia. Now, general anesthesia itself is considered very safe, and the anesthesiologists say that they feel that it's much safer because in general anesthesia, they literally put a tube down into your trachea, and they breathe for you while you're asleep. Whereas in sedation, when you're out cold, they may or may not have any kind of tube in, and therefore, if something were to happen and you couldn't breathe, they don't have what they call control of your airway. So it's a little bit actually more concerning to anesthesiologists. So they actually consider general anesthesia safer because they know they're in control. They've got all the medications. They have an IV functioning. They've got machines you're connected to, and they're in control, so they consider that very safe. That being said, any doctor that I've ever operated on doesn't want to have a tube put down their throat. They want to have sedation for everything, even though statistically it's actually less safe. But just as a person, knowing that someone else is in control of you, it's a very difficult thing to give away. So that's the answer about anesthesia. As far as, what else did you ask? As far as men go, we were talking about the norm, and the truth is statistically it is sort of the norm for men to have different kinds of cosmetic surgery, and therefore, as you try to decide, is something in the norm, or is a man allowed to do something in today's day and age? It actually is the norm for a lot of men to do it statistically, I believe. The only other thing I wanted to mention also is in terms of what you hear in the newspapers, I think, about people dying from plastic surgery. You don't really hear about it happening in the hospital, and the truth is, when you hear about it in the newspaper, it's almost never a board-certified plastic surgeon with a board-certified anesthesiologist in a licensed surgery center, you know, like the one we have. It's always some weird story, you know, somebody died on Central Park South doing a nose job a year ago, and everybody was all up in arms. And then when you start listening to the story further, they said, yeah, the doctor finished the surgery, started the surgery at 11 o'clock at night, and finished 2 o'clock in the morning, and he went home. And then at 7 o'clock in the morning, the patient woke up, felt dizzy, and she fainted, and she died right in his waiting room. And everybody was all up in arms. Oh, my God, plastic surgery is not safe. And I read that story, and I said, oh, my God, why was he starting an operation at 11 o'clock at night? It didn't make any sense. And once you hear that something's not making any sense, you really don't know what's going on there. But in most cases, it actually is very safe. The anesthesiologists are safe. The surgeons are safe. The surgeries are safe. So as far as sakana goes, it really isn't anymore, I don't think. If I could read my handwriting, I would tell you more. One more thing.
I graduated
medical school. Cosmetic surgery, without a doubt, should not be done on anybody. And the truth is, any surgery, any procedure that's done in medicine should not be done without a lengthy discussion with the patient. We have consent forms to sign, and the residents go up there, here, you have to sign this because the doctor's doing this. Not the right way to do it. When I'm doing cosmetic surgery, I will absolutely sit down probably for an hour with somebody, tell them everything that can go wrong, and then let them decide. And if at any point during that hour discussion the person says, I'm doing this because, you know, my husband this or my husband that, or I'm doing this because of the reasons you alluded to before, my job this or my job that, bells go off. Something's a problem here. The person's not doing it. 99% of the patients that come in, they're doing it for themselves. They never like their nose. They never like their chest. This thigh always bothers them. Whatever it is, somebody's got to be doing it for themselves. And all of the other reasons that people mention that they might be doing it for are all wrong. And can you find somebody to do that surgery anyway? Absolutely. Have I turned people away and said, I won't do this surgery? Yes. Have those patients gone somewhere and found somebody who would take their money and go do their surgery? Yeah, it's happened. But we deal with these issues all the time, but there's the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things. You find that in every specialty that you have. I have to tell you, by the way, v'hafta l'reacha kamocha in medicine doesn't always apply, but you try. What else? I think that was it. Any other questions for us? I don't know, the time of hours late.
That's for you, I think. I think the question was for you. It wasn't for me. I think the postcum do discuss, if I'm not mistaken. I have not, to be honest, personally checked into or researched that particular topic. I think they do discuss it. I do not have any specific information about it. I think one of the issues that probably is discussed is the issue of lo yilbash gever. Certainly that would be a radical form of identification, as well as other issues. So I don't think that one would find any posek who would ever recommend such a thing. But not that the person's orientation should be taken lightly. That needs to be addressed in a different manner. But I think there are, in the library here, there's some really wonderful resources on medical ethics. First of all, there's an Encyclopedia of Bioethics put out in the library. If you ever see me around, I'm sure I'm more than happy to show you. And there was reference library. There's a wonderful 6-volume work of Encyclopedia of Bioethics, general bioethics, secular bioethics, excellent work. And there's some article in the back of the reference library by Dr. Abraham and Dr. Steinberg. So I think you might find some of those discussions in those, and if you want, I'll show you where they are in the reference library.
Fred Rosner.
And Fred Rosner as well. There are some, the library has some of his books as well, Rabbi Blythe, Rabbi Tendler. In terms of some of your discussions, I think you might find them in there, and happy to refer them to you. It's an interesting question. I honestly did not look to see if Waldenberg addressed that issue, so I can't tell you definitively or authoritatively. I don't believe that they would consider it to be a Baal Mum. Once it has been surgically repaired, it undergoes a healing process, assuming that that's an example of a microsurgical procedure that Dr. Berg referred to earlier. And the statistics on that, if I'm not mistaken, are very good success rates in general with reattachment of certainly single digits. And as a result, once it's healed and it's functioning, and therefore the only question you might ask, well, what if it doesn't function as well? Would that be considered to be a mum? If it's aesthetically, it's been improved, but not functionally. But we don't invalidate a coin because of functional defects necessarily. It's usually anatomic defects. So, but that's just kind of a brief discussion. I can't give you an authoritative opinion. Very interesting question. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you.
Hi, guys. I just want to thank our two speakers. It was very interesting. Thank you guys for taking time and coming to speak. I also want to thank TAC and CJF for sponsoring us. I also want to thank everyone on the Medical Ethics Board who helped out with this event. Also, if anyone is interested in becoming involved in the Medical Ethics Society, please contact either me or Elisheva Levine. All right, I hope you enjoy. Thanks for coming. Thank you so much.